Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning. Welcome Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600.
Welcome back to the show, Congressman Himes. Thanks for being here. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Doing great, thank you.
So I saw the Senate voted on a bipartisan basis last night to pass a massive $1.5 trillion government funding bill. And a good chunk of it, a little over $13 billion of it, is for Ukraine. Do you think the president will sign it?
Oh, he sure will. Yeah, the Senate passed it last night. We passed it late the night before. It's exciting news, Melissa. You know, first of all, it is the federal budget, right? So everything that we rely on, Medicare, Social Security, the military, it's all in there. And as you point out, yes, it's $13 billion, which for Ukraine is a huge amount of money, part of which is military aid. Roughly $3 or $4 billion of that is military and security aid for Ukraine, so we can continue to keep the weapons flowing to the just remarkable fighters there. And then a lot of that is also to assist, you know, the fact that some 2 million, I mean, just a staggering number, 2 million refugees have left Ukraine. They're obviously in places like Poland and Romania, and we're going to do our part to help them. But, yeah, very exciting week. And includes, by the way, we can come back to Ukraine if you like, because I know that's what's on people's mind. But for the first time in a dozen years or so, the budget is going to include some specific projects for our areas, for the city of Bridgeport. The town of Monroe is going to get some money in the budget to put to help their STEM efforts by putting computers into computer labs. And so there's going to be some really nice local effects from the budget that passed. The president hasn't signed it yet, but yes, he's going to sign it.
So, Congressman Himes, I think there are some good things, obviously, coming out of this. And I want to make it super clear, because I think my listeners know I absolutely stand with Ukraine. I am partially Ukrainian, so I certainly understand supporting Ukraine. And I think the only devastating part, I mean, I'm sure there's others, but the thing that stands out to me that I think is very devastating is I feel there is this misunderstanding, or at least this blanketed idea that the economy is doing better, that COVID is becoming the rearview mirror, which fine. But I think there's an entire industry that is suffering tremendously, and that's the restaurants and hospitality. And I'm very surprised that we're, again, I understand Ukraine needs it. I'm certainly not saying we shouldn't help Ukraine, but to give $13 billion to Ukraine right now when we have thousands of restaurants that are going to shut down now. I mean, they're going to shut down now in the next month or two. And now you have probably hundreds of thousands of workers who are going to be out of a job here in the United States. I'm kind of surprised we didn't put more money into the restaurant and hospitality industry in the U.S.
Well, it's not an either or, right? I mean, just we sent many billions of dollars a year, a little over a year ago, to the restaurant industry at a time when, you know, people couldn't go to restaurants, right? Today restaurants are actually full. I was in one of them in Stanford last night, and it was full. And so you shouldn't think of it as either or. In other words, you know, helping the Ukrainians doesn't, which I think is really critical, doesn't mean we can't help the restaurant industry. Now, you may have noticed if you watched the news, we did try to do about $15 billion in additional COVID funds. And ultimately, the Republicans opposed that in the Senate. They said, you know, we had to take that number down well below what would have helped the restaurants. But, you know, we've talked about this before. I do know that, you know, not just restaurants, but a number of retail businesses have suffered badly. And the conversation's not over. You know, I think that if, heaven forbid, and I really do mean that, heaven forbid, if we were to see another variant that came back around and, you know, forced us once again to sort of tail back our sort of public activities, there would be discussion of retail and restaurants. But again, I know I've spent a lot of time with local restaurant owners. They've been through absolute hell. But, I mean, the good news is now, you know, it's pretty tough to get a reservation into a lot of restaurants. So I think they are on the upswing.
I think some are. I do know that there are a lot who are not. Unfortunately, you know, I think we did get that variant. I think Omicron hit them badly. And I think we, you know, we as consumers, like you and I have talked about before, you know, why we gave out the checks, for example, why we gave out the checks in the beginning of the pandemic to people. And it was so we can then, you know, be able to kind of circle a life. We can go in and go to restaurants and support restaurants. We can go to hotels. But like, people don't even want to get in the car right now to even go to the grocery store, let alone go to a restaurant. I think, unfortunately, whether it's COVID, inflation, gas prices, I think the general consumer right now, it maybe I don't think they're going to restaurants as much as I think restaurants were hoping they would. And I'm wondering if the revitalization program, yes, it was super vital 2 years ago, but I don't see where they really did recover overall as much as I think the narrative is saying. At least that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot at play here, right? I mean, I think it's almost certain that some restaurants are probably packed. I mean, I swing by them pretty frequently myself. Some of them are really packed. Some of them are having a harder time. I'm not quite sure what the difference is. And, you know, you are right. With inflation and with higher gasoline prices, you know, people have a little less disposable income to actually go to those restaurants. So I totally agree that we're not totally out of the woods yet. But we're facing a lot of political headwinds. I mean, my Republican friends are already saying we spent way too much money, and that's why we have inflation during COVID. Now, remember, that money that we spent was the Paycheck Protection Program that helped a lot of restaurants keep their staff online, and then the actual direct restaurant program that did that. So a lot of money was spent. There's now you could be on either side of it. As you might imagine, it's my Republican friends that are a little bit more skeptical about spending more money on COVID. But they're already saying we spent too much. And so, I think so long as we don't see another variant, because it does appear that maybe we're on the other side of the Omicron variant. Some people will be unhappy with this, but we've probably done most of the spending or all of the spending that we're going to do to address the COVID crisis.
Okay, so I just want to confirm. So we're not going to put any money into like another restaurant revitalization program.
I think it's unlikely. Again, we tried to do $15 billion to provide additional vaccines, because some of the vaccine programs that are out there to address lower income people, some of the therapy purchases, we tried to do $15 billion and we couldn't get that done this week. So, I think now if we, as I said before, heaven forbid, if we see another variant, if we see another wave of something like Omicron, all bets are off, because of course that'll you know, again, hopefully it doesn't happen, but that'll throw us kind of back to where we were 6 months, 7 months ago, and then I think we'll go back to thinking about that stuff. But the perception is that while we're not out of the woods yet economically, I mean, look at the economic numbers, right? Unemployment is down to 3.8%. Hundreds of thousands of jobs added. Economically speaking, with the exception of inflation, which is, by the way, a symptom of people spending a lot of money. Why do you get inflation? Because too many people are spending too much money trying to buy too few goods, right? I think right now, love it or hate it, the notion is that unless we see another variant, there's not going to be a lot more government spending for COVID.
Okay. Congressman Himes, I appreciate you talking about this. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I know we'll chat again next week. Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Melissa. Take care.
What's happening in Hartford and how it affects you? Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly joins Melissa in the morning now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Kelly. Thanks for being here. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Yourself, Melissa?
I can't complain. I mean, I could, but I don't want to. So
exactly.
Thank you, though. You know, let's get right into the whole gas tax situation, because I know, you know, it's interesting. This is something that you have been pushing for weeks, even before the whole Russia-Ukraine situation, actually. You wanted to get rid of the sales tax, which nothing's happened. And we also wanted to drop the gas tax because of inflation rates. And I'm curious, it looks like we're getting a little more support on this. But I'm pretty shocked at this point that we're getting just closer and closer, inching up to $5 a gallon, and we still can't figure out getting rid of this tax. I find it very shocking, quite frankly.
Likewise, I mean, I'm a bit dismayed by the majority's indifference to the plight of everyday working families in the state of Connecticut. And it's not just something new because we're experiencing inflation, Melissa. Yes, we looked at the sales tax, and now we're looking at a gas tax. But let's be mindful. We opposed the gas tax last spring, summer, and into the fall when the Democrats were after the taxpayers' wallet. We were against tolls. They put a $100 million truck tax on the backs of Connecticut taxpayers, which come January 1st is going to increase the cost of goods and services in the state of Connecticut. So it's a full-time job trying to keep these Democrats in line from looking at the taxpayers' wallet as the solution to everything. Now, here what we have is a windfall because of the inflation, because of the poor Connecticut economy. The receipts of gas taxes and sales taxes are more than anticipated. And our idea is let's cut the gas tax, the sales tax, leave the money in the taxpayers' wallet who are struggling today. The Democrats they're offering tax relief, and by no means are we against tax relief in this form either, but
sure.
Their tax relief are credits that you claim when you file an income tax next year. And I think a year from now we'll deal with, but today Connecticut families are feeling the pinch of high inflation, high gas costs, and need the relief now, not next year sometime when they file a next year's income tax return.
So let me just get this straight, because I know it's up for debate, at least according to Governor Lamont, he's open to a gas tax holiday, which I don't actually know what that means. What is a gas tax holiday? What does that mean?
Well, I think what we're looking at is suspending the gas. We're looking at suspending the gross receipts tax so that it's not imposed on the cost of gasoline in the state of Connecticut. He's calling it a holiday, we're calling it a suspension.
But it's the same thing.
I'm not going to say it's the same thing because, well, on one side he's saying that. On another, he's also saying he doesn't want to, you know, he's going to look at all forms. And I know the majority, you know, my friends in the General Assembly are looking at a gas tax credit. So in other words, you pay your gas taxes today, and you file your income tax next year and claim your credits back. And
so we wouldn't see that money.
Relief,
okay, so we wouldn't even see that money for a year. I see what you're saying. Okay. Because
right.
they were saying either rebate checks or a tax credit. But rebate checks, you're saying we wouldn't even see that money really immediately either, right?
Well, who knows what that means? I mean, these are just ideas. I mean, this is the difference. When we come out with a plan, and I suggest any of your listeners go to betterwayct.com, you'll see all our plans that will demonstrate how the Republicans would govern if given the opportunity to do so. And we put pencil to paper. We show how much it's going to cost to give this tax relief, and then we go after it and say, okay, we can reduce the gross receipts. Governor's throwing up against the wall. Oh, tax credits and rebates. Well, what does that look like? What are the particulars? I do know that by reducing the gross receipts tax, that can happen today. It can happen immediately. The rebate check, you're going to have to deal with bureaucracy. You're going to have to get a check printed. You're going to have to deal with returning money and putting it in taxpayers' bank account. I think the best way to deal with this is not even take the money out of the taxpayer's wallet. Let's just reduce the rate. Let's suspend it for now. See where we are come July 1. If we have to continue, then we can continue. But this way you give the relief at the pump when it's happening.
I think it's confusing, Senator Kelly, because for the last year and a half, we've been touting the fact that Connecticut has gotten a boatload of money, essentially, from the federal government during COVID. We have this really hefty rainy day fund. You know, we've just got money and money and money. That's what it sounds like, at least from the layperson, myself. You know, a regular resident, an everyday person. It just sounds like Connecticut's got all this stored money, essentially. And I'm wondering why we're being so reactionary. Like, why are we waiting till we get to $5 a gallon to then say, I guess we'll get rid of the gas tax. I guess we could eliminate that 18 cents a gallon or that 26 cents a gallon. It's not even, you know, all it's going to do is just bring us back down to where we are this week, essentially paying for gas. I just don't understand why we're squeezing so hard. It's very confusing, honestly, as a taxpayer, why we're going to wait so long before, whether it's a tax credit, whether it's a rebate check, whether it's dropping the gas tax. Like, and essentially all it's going to do is just bring us back to what we're paying right now. Like right now where we're already struggling. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. You are absolutely correct. We are awash with federal money. We do have some financial, I'm going to say, guidelines and structures that were put in place when Republicans were tied in the Senate that have resulted in the highest rainy day fund in the history of the state of Connecticut. And it's mind-boggling that when we put a proposal on the table that's budget neutral, it won't even get into those funds. The Democrats really don't have a strident appetite to meet us there and to help the people and families of Connecticut. That's what we're doing. And I think that's a big difference between the leadership on both sides of the aisle, is that the Democrats are dragging their feet when they have to give back the taxpayer sacrifice. But we recognize that families are struggling and we don't want to take it in the first place.
Senator Kelly, really quick, I saw a quote from State Rep Scanlon yesterday saying there are studies that show the gas tax suspensions don't actually mean real savings for drivers, so why would we get rid of it? What's your response to that?
Well, here's the thing. In 2012, we created a law that allows the Attorney General to seek individuals, in this case, somebody who would get a repeal of the wholesale and not pass it on to consumers as a price gouger. You've also heard the Attorney General earlier in the week, I think, talk about how if anybody thinks they've been price gouged, contact his office because mm-hmm. he would do something about it.
Right.
So we are armed with that ability. We can embed that in the law and also look at, just say, this has to be passed on to the consumer. Otherwise, the tax will be levied on that individual. So there's a way to legislatively do this. The question is, does the majority have the will to find that way? I know if we were in charge, we would find the way because we respect the sacrifice taxpayers make. And that's what's really at issue here, is why are they dragging their feet, both on the sales tax, now on the gas tax, to return this sacrifice when the state is getting a windfall? We shouldn't profit off of high inflation. That would actually be price gouging on behalf of the taxpayer. So there's a difference of opinion here, but I think what we need to do is to get people to know this. They can go to our website and stopthegastaxct.com, sign our petition. We're going to present that to the majority, and hopefully we get some relief.
Senator Kelly, we appreciate the work you're doing, and we thank you so much for sharing it on the air this morning.
You bet. Anytime.
All right. We'll talk soon. That's Senator Kevin Kelly here on WICC. Our eyes are so focused on what's going on overseas between Russia and Ukraine, and I thought it would be interesting to do kind of a history lesson a little bit, understanding what sort of sparked this entire issue and sort of the mind of President Vladimir Putin and understanding him. And I want to make something very clear. I don't want to understand him because I want to find any reason to support what is going on. I want to understand it because I do think it's fascinating when you read sometimes these books about these dictators or these leaders, these people who make decisions that can alter countries and really the globe, and understanding what led up to their thinking and to their actions. So I just wanted to make that very clear. I'm not sitting here trying to give you any excuse to support Vladimir Putin. But I do think it's interesting to understand his background and what got him to the place that we're in today. So joining me this morning, I'm excited to have on Bradley Woodworth. He's an associate professor of history at the University of New Haven. He also has done a lot of work in Russia, spent time over there, and I'm excited to have him on the show this morning. Good morning, Bradley. How are you?
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being here. First, Bradley, before we dive into what is currently going on and what led us up to today, I did have kind of a personal question that I think
sure.
other people may have this question. So when you look at Ukraine, They became independent only a little over 20 years ago, but they used to be obviously owned by Russia. That's part of this history that we're going to talk about. If you are Russian, so for example, I always grew up knowing I was Russian. But it turns out, as I've gotten older, I learned that my family, my great-great-grandparents, came from Kiev, from Ukraine. And so my question is, you know, a lot of times you'll find generations ago, there were countries either owned by other countries or weren't even established yet. But now, fast forward to modern day, they're their own country or they're their own identity. So would I remain Russian? Am I Ukrainian? What do you call me? What am I? Who am I? Tell me who I am. Well, you and I have never met, but who am I? Tell me.
Well, Melissa, the good thing is that it's up to you to decide who you are. You used an interesting word there in your lead in, and that is identity. Right? Who are we? Who are we as a group? Who gets to decide who we are? How do we set our goals for the future? And this goes to the heart of the problem right now. First, I would just like to say that what's happening right now these last few days or in this last week, in many ways, can't even be explained by history. Vladimir Putin has found out that what he envisioned for a future of Russia and Ukraine together is being rejected by all people in Ukraine. And he is so furious at this that he is willing to go and kill individuals, civilians. And that's what we're seeing. So it's you're right. That really cannot be explained other than simply, you know, someone's anger. But to your question of identity, you know, today, especially in the 20th century now and 21st century, we see ourselves as citizens, right? That we have the right as an individual to have a voice in our government, and that the way our countries throughout the world are run is that those citizens get to decide. Vladimir Putin doesn't hold to that idea. That idea is rooted in the Enlightenment of the 18th century, that we as individuals matter, right? And then we're not told by a lord, you know, or by anyone that owns us how we're going to live. We each get to decide. And so what Putin is so furious about is that people throughout Ukraine, whether their native language is Ukrainian or Russian, he's furious that they're turning their backs. And they're looking towards the West. And so he'd rather kill them.
Interesting. How did he even become who he is today, Bradley? For people who don't know, you know, I understand in reading, you know, on my own, it's not like he came from a bad family or anything like that. But how did he get the mindset of where he is today? I know part of it is, like you said, his anger. You know, there's got to be some ego, some anger, you know, all that mixed in. That's personality. But what is sort of his background, his history?
Well, you know, we all know about his history in the KGB. He came to power really in 1999, when the outgoing president of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, who had been the leader of Russia in the late the Russian Republic within the Soviet Union in the late 1980s, and then 1991 when the Soviet Union broke apart, and when Yeltsin was ailing and looking for someone to, Russia was was having elections, and so this person would have to be elected, but right, the imprimatur, the approval of Yeltsin would matter a lot. He picked this a person who had risen through the 1990s in the security apparatus. And what was really key here is that, like many Russian elites in the 1990s and, of course, today, there were financial improprieties. Yeltsin got a promise from Putin that Putin would not come after his family, would protect him. That was the wrong choice. There was another young, rising a politician named Boris Nemtsov, this very charismatic, very intelligent man who he could have picked, really was the one that should have been picked. That is a fateful decision made by Yeltsin in 1999, that he did not pick Boris Nemtsov to be his successor. 7 years ago, Nemtsov was shot dead in Moscow on a bridge close to the Kremlin. So Putin has been the president now for 22 years, or just over 21 years. Putin has been the president at a time when Russia has been recovering from the from the economic problems of the 1990s, and he had shepherded Russia to economic success and recovery and prosperity, of course, always leaning on the presence of natural resources in that God granted the people of that area with oil in the ground, but had brought a lot of prosperity. In the last several years, though, Putin has become more and more isolated. Of course, that was exacerbated by the COVID crisis, and is thinking less and less about everyday about people's lives. A leading Russian journalist just published an article. Someone who had studied the Russian elite for a number of years and really emphasizes the degree to which Putin has really only been talking to a couple people, completely isolated, and thinking more and more about the legacy that he would leave to Russia, thinking about the greatness of Russia, not so much in the Soviet period, really, but in the past of the Russian Empire, in the 18th century and 19th century. And he's become fixated on this idea of leaving behind a Russian empire that he has put back together. Mm. And so that's why he's trying to hold on to Ukraine, beginning in 2004 and then especially 2014, beginning to turn its back in 2014 directly looking to the West and wanting to have closer economic and political ties with Western Europe and Central Europe. And this infuriated Putin, and he invaded Ukraine in 2014, took the Crimea, and invaded several provinces, several regions in Western Ukraine. And that was really just the lead-in to this moment where he felt, Putin, that the West was disorganized. And this was the moment to make sure that Ukraine would not leave the sphere of Russian influence.
Thank you for holding. Sorry about that, Bradley. So we're chatting with Bradley Woodworth this morning of the University of New Haven. Quick question. Has anyone had even a shot at unseating Putin as president?
No, absolutely not. There have been elections since he began his presidency in 2000, but they have been for show. And what really I think is noteworthy over the last about 10 years is that Putin has increasingly brought state power under his personal control. I mean, even state officials that are elected in the lands throughout Russia are really take orders from him, and are set up for to be elected through the party, Единая Россия, United Russia, that Putin controls. So Russia, on paper, is a democracy where people have the right to vote. But that vote is so controlled by the state and by Putin's power. And the other form of power that Putin has is over the press, over the media.
That's what I was
going to talk
about.
The kind of information that people give. I mean, it's incredible what we all know is happening in Ukraine. People in Russia do not know. Now, many young people, particularly young educated people that are internet savvy, can and get news from the outside and know where to go to get news outside of these official state sources, know what's going on. But the older generations don't. And there's been over this last 10 years a fear instilled by Putin in people that the West, particularly the United States, is their enemy. We are to be feared. We want to hurt them. We want to expand our military power throughout Europe. This has been stressed by Putin that the security arrangements that currently exist in throughout Europe and the United States and through the power of NATO, the security alliance that was established after World War II, is aimed at against Russia. So Putin is telling people really in many ways that what's important is in all of Europe is not, what the French want or what Germans want, that they're really under the control of Washington and that Washington, the Americans are really making the decisions here. And that's really, really worrisome because we've got millions of people in Russia that don't really have a clear idea of reality, that their views of the world and their views of who they are and also their views of their past have been so controlled. And so this is something that concerns me. I mean, I just read yesterday sociologists in Russia that had done some polling were positing that as many as 60% of the population were supporting this military action. It's actually illegal in Russia to call it a war. But I think we have to be really careful before we decide what the Russian people want. Their whole worldview has been so controlled for so many years.
I'm surprised you went there. I'd be scared to go there. Not to be, I'm just saying, Bradley, I'm surprised that you lived there as an American.
Well, so I first went to, it was in the Soviet Union, I first went to Russia in 1985. In that spring of 1985, a young communist official was selected for the position of general secretary of the Communist Party, meaning head of the state, and his name was Mikhail Gorbachev. Mikhail Gorbachev, over the next several years, began a series of reforms. You might remember the word perestroika in Russian, means restructuring, and also glasnost, which was an opening up of what could be said. Mikhail Gorbachev believed in his country. The American, his American biographer, William Tautman, at the University of Amherst, strongly believes that Gorbachev deeply was a moral individual, raised by good parents, grandparents that loved him. Mikhail Gorbachev wasn't going to kill people. And when he saw that people in Eastern Europe did not want to be under the thumb of Moscow anymore, he let them go. That's how Germany became reunited. And that's how the countries that the Soviet Union had occupied after World War II and then controlled through communist parties, so Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia, he let them go. He let them go from Moscow's control. And that's something that sticks in Putin's craw. He's furious about that, right? That this larger influence, first off, the larger Russian Empire that had existed before World War I and that continued after World War I in the form of the Soviet Union, was diminished after World War II, and Putin would like to go back to that. And this is really, really concerning, because if he has success in Ukraine, then he himself has said he wants to go back to the power of this Russian Empire. That
could be a
threat,
domino effect.
It could be a threat on Poland, on Baltic states. These were parts of Russian influence throughout for three centuries.
Right.
But after 1991, they've been independent countries, and then in the early 2000s were accepted in the European Union and NATO. And we need to defend them.
Yeah, Bradley, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I'd love to have you back on the show as soon as possible. I think this is a lot of fascinating information, and I thank you for taking the time.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
All right, Bradley Woodworth here from the University of New Haven on WICC.